The Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing.
As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, meets with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, on his second day of the visit to the country. Tehran strongly condemns the Arab League for its recent anti-Iran statement, saying such a move is aimed at deflecting attention from the war on Yemen. Also ahead, the Pentagon says it is considering keeping National Guard troops at the U.S. Capitol amid continued threats from extremist groups. It's great to have you with us. Now, our top story: the head of the Roman Catholic Church has met with Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, on his second day of a historic visit to the Arab country. Pope Francis met Ayatollah Sistani at his home in the holy city of Najaf. This is the first such meeting between the leaders of the two religions. The visit was made under tight security, with no press allowed inside. Pope Francis arrived in Baghdad on Friday, where he was welcomed by Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi and President Barham Saleh. During their meeting, the pontiff called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance. The Pope is scheduled to visit the site of the ancient city of Ur, where he will host an interfaith service. He will also visit Mosul, the former stronghold of Daesh terrorists, before returning to Rome on Monday. The Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations says the Israeli occupation has gravely violated the rights of Palestinian children, with the regime facing no consequences for its actions. Riyad Mansour highlighted the plight of the Palestinians in three identical letters sent to the UN chief, as well as the presidents of the Security Council and the General Assembly. Mansour said the occupation has direct impact on the safety, physical and mental health of children. The letters mentioned the Israeli land grab policy, deadly crackdown on protests, and the arbitrary arrest of civilians, including children. The top diplomat said a teenager attending an anti-settlement rally is the latest victim. According to the UN, Israel has demolished nearly 227 Palestinian homes, displacing around 200 children this year alone. According to data provided by rights groups, more than 170 Palestinian children are also being held in Israeli prisons without charges or trials. Iran's foreign ministry has slammed the Arab League for pushing its futile claims about three Iranian islands in the Persian Gulf. The ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, said the claim that the islands are occupied by Iran is baseless and provocative at the same time, and does not change the historical facts. Khatibzadeh noted that the islands of Abu Musa, the Lesser Tomb and the Greater Tomb remain inseparable parts of the Iranian territory. He also said the Arab League's members make such damaging allegations against Iran to dodge responsibility for their vicious acts, including their devastating war on Yemen and their disregard for the Palestinian cause. Former U.S. psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett says the accusation by some Arab countries that Iran is occupying three islands in the Persian Gulf is just a blame game to deflect attention from their own crimes.
Well, it's being used as a diplomatic misdirection and a distraction, no doubt, for some of the other information operations and kinetic activities that the Wahhabi UAE and Saudi Arabia and some of these other forces are no doubt planning and exercising. It's a convenient way to as previously observed, distract away from some of the more bloodthirsty war crimes that, of course, they have been committing under the Saudi Arabian war against Yemen and of the continued brutalization against the Palestinian people. So this is really a misdirection, psychological operation to distract people away from, I think, the rising tide of truth and moral authority which Iran is now quickly accelerating in with the demise of the U.S. administration, Joe Biden, losing all moral gravitas and any mental clarity. Iran is now in a position to really reestablish itself.
Iran's permanent representative to international organizations in Vienna has slammed Israel for assassinating his country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. At a meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors, Kazem Gharibabadi said clear evidence suggests Israel masterminded Fakhrizadeh's assassination. He said Tel Aviv must be held accountable for the murder, calling on the IAEA and its members to strongly condemn the, quote, inhumane crime. The envoy said that Iran will not leave such a heinous crime unanswered. Gharibabadi also emphasized Tehran's commitment to pursuing a peaceful nuclear program. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in late November when his car was ambushed near the Iranian capital, Tehran. The Yemeni army says its drones have successfully hit major targets at King Khalid Air Base in Saudi Arabia's Asir province. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said two Samad 3 drones were used in the operation. Sari said that the attacks were in response to Saudi Arabia's continued aggression and blockade against the Yemeni people. King Khalid Air Base and other military targets in the south of the Arab Kingdom have been repeatedly hit by Yemeni drones in recent days. On Thursday, the Yemeni army also launched a missile attack on an Aramco oil facility in Jeddah. Yemenis have held a protest in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a to condemn the UN donor conference. The protesters renewed their calls on the international organization to make Saudi Arabia responsible for piracy against Yemeni oil ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
Yemenis talk together in front of the UN office in Sana'a to slam the UN donor conference and renew their calls on the international organization and the international community to end the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We hope that they will talk about the ships of oil derivatives at the donors' conference. The Yemeni people need fuel just as they need food and medicine. There are thousands of trucks carrying aid that are parked in and could not reach the Yemenis because of the lack of fuel. We want serious action from the United Nations to release oil ships.
Protesters described the UN donor conference as a historical farce. Yemenis said the detained oil vessels must be released and the Saudi war as well as the blockade of Yemen must be stopped.
The donors conference is nothing more than a historical farce. We do not need humanitarian aid, but rather to lift the blockade and release oil ships.
The Yemenis do not need a donor conference as much as they need to bring in oil ships, and we do not want the United Nations to begin in the name of our dear people.
14 Yemeni oil ships remain at the Saudi-led coalition's detention illegally. The vessels were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. The detention has led the country to a harsh shortage of fuel.
Yemenis say instead of raising funds for its organization's expenses, the UN must pressure Saudi Arabia to release the detained oil vessels if it wants to help the humanitarian situation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Pentagon says it is reviewing a request to extend the presence of National Guard troops deployed to the U.S. capital following the January 6 insurrection. The Defense Department spokesman, John Kirby, says Capitol Police have asked for the continued assistance of the National Guard for another 2 months. Some 5,000 troops were mobilized and barriers erected around the Capitol after thousands of supporters of then-President Donald Trump stormed the building. That's after Trump called them to stop lawmakers from certifying Joe Biden's election win. The breach led to the death of 5 people, including a policeman. More than 270 people are being prosecuted for their participation in the attack. Authorities have been on high alert since Thursday after intelligence showed a possible plot by a militia group to breach Congress again. correspondent in Washington, Connie Campbell, says U.S. politicians want to keep National Guard troops at the Capitol to show that they are doing something to prevent a new insurrection.
The U.S. government believes that the National Guard needs to have a presence to either intimidate anyone who may want to cause harm or to intervene in case there are people actively engaged in trying to create destruction. And I think that's why they're extending this. There are other reporters who I spoke to this week who believe that this National Guard is being put in place so that politicians can show that they're doing something because they missed the boat on January 6th, that they overlooked things, they should have been more diligent, and they weren't, and this is their mode of playing catch-up to have the National Guard there now. It looks like because of these potential insurgencies that could come to Congress, could come to Washington, National Guard will be up in D.C. longer than anticipated.
Staying in the United States, where resentment is rising after President Joe Biden backtracked on his promise to raise the minimum wage to $15 per hour. However, studies have shown that considering the constant inflation in the country, even $15 per hour would not constitute a living wage for single adult households in any state. Rami Mazahari is in Chicago.
In his very first campaign speech to win the presidential election, Joe Biden promised to more than double the federal minimum wage from just over $7 an hour to a minimum of $15 per hour. However, the ruling Democratic Party has retracted the wage increase from the third fiscal stimulus negotiations, disappointing 30 million low-wage workers in the middle of a once-in-a-century economic crisis. There is a whopping 75% public approval rating for Biden's stimulus program, but those polls came out before many of the details were released. Biden has since pulled support for many of the economic promises he made during his election campaign. After just 1 month in office, Biden has so far backtracked on his promises for major student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and he has made no mention of reversing Donald Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, something that Biden promised to initiate on his very first day in office.
It really shows the bankruptcy of every 4 years, this incrementalism where the left in the United States is pressured into getting behind the Democratic candidate, not going third party. Why? Because, oh, well, we're going to get these small concessions, like something like, hey, a $15 minimum wage increase or student loan debt, things like that.
However, countless economists insist that a wage increase would stimulate the economy overall by giving workers more money to spend, thus creating jobs and badly needed growth.
By doing that, by saying that, you know, it's impacting small businesses, what they're effectively doing is taking the economic burden that's put on small businesses by corporations, which own and control the politicians in Washington, they're shifting that burden onto workers and making workers pay the price.
The so-called fight for $15 began shortly after 2009, which is the last year the federal minimum wage was increased. But a decade later, studies show that constant inflation means that $15 per hour in 2021 would not constitute a living wage for a single adult household in any state. The study said in the cheapest metropolitan areas, $20 per hour is now required, while major cities would need $25 per hour. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
India farmers have blocked a six-lane expressway outside the capital, New Delhi, to mark the 100th day of their protests against the new agricultural reforms. Farmers, young and old, headed in cars, trucks and tractors to the highway for a five-hour roadblock to oppose three farm laws enacted in September 2020. They also say the laws hurt them by opening up the agriculture sector to private players. The fresh protest comes to add pressure on Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government. Meanwhile, Modi has called the laws much needed for the country's vast and antiquated agriculture sector. He has dismissed the possibility of He has dismissed the protests as politically motivated. Tens of thousands of farmers have been camped out on the outskirts of the capital since December, demanding that the laws be repealed. Indian-controlled Kashmir has witnessed yet another angry protest after authorities reversed their decision to release the region's top Muslim cleric from house arrest. Protesters threw stones and clashed with police outside the main mosque of the city of Srinagar after Friday prayers. They demanded the release of Marwaz Omar Farooq, who has been under house arrest for 20 months. He was among dozens of religious and political figures put under house arrest in 2019. That after the ruling right-wing Indian government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked the special constitutional status of the disputed Himalayan region. Since then, New Delhi has also enforced a heavy security lockdown there. India and Pakistan control parts of Kashmir, but both lay claim to the full area. Myanmar security forces have once again clashed with anti-coup protesters in the country's largest city of Yangon. The security forces fired tear gas and destroyed the barricade erected by the protesters. On Friday, police opened fire on the protesters in another city, killing a man. More than 50 people have been killed since the coup. The UN described last Wednesday as the bloodiest when 40 people were killed in a military crackdown. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar has called on the Security Council for action against the post-coup violence in the Southeast Asian country. Myanmar has been engulfed by chaos after the army seized power on February the 1st, alleging fraud in the last parliamentary elections. It also detained a number of civilian officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. NASA's Mars rover, dubbed Perseverance, has successfully completed its first ever test drive on the red planet. The six-wheeled rover traveled more than 6 meters in 33 minutes. NASA officials called the mission a huge milestone. They also released images showing the robot's wheel tracks on the surface of the planet and surrounding landscape. NASA engineers say they are now preparing for the first flight of a helicopter drone carried by the rover. Perseverance was launched last summer and landed on Mars earlier in February. Its main goal is to search for traces of ancient microbial life there. It is going to collect soil and rock samples from the Martian surface and send them back to Earth in the next decade for analysis. Anti-monarchy activists in Catalonia have held a demonstration to protest a visit by King Philippe and Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. The royal visit comes weeks after the region was rocked by violent riots following the imprisonment of a musician for tweets and lyrics against the monarchy. Kosei Kadri has more in this report.
Monarchy activists showed up at the headquarters of Spain's car manufacturer SEAT in the north of Barcelona to protest the visit by King Felipe and Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. Protesters shouted slogans against the monarch and held banners reading "Catalonia has no king," 1 week after violent riots shook the region over the imprisonment of a rapper for insulting Spanish royals.
The rejection of the Spanish monarchy has become a recurrent theme with every royal visit to Catalonia over the past years. Here are some of the grievances with regard to this particular visit to the car factory.
The King of Spain will never be welcome in Catalonia. The King of the October 3rd speech, the King who 3.5 years ago called business owners to urge them to relocate their headquarters out of Catalonia, is not welcome.
The Spanish government Thursday announced it will dedicate part of the Coronavirus European Recovery Fund to launch an electric car battery plant with SEAT's parent company, Volkswagen. But trade unions say the transition towards a greener economy requires transparent labor reforms and should not overlook basic rights.
We need to know how the European Recovery Fund is going to be spent. We believe it should be entirely put under public administration. The investments in the car industry should be in compliance with public interest first, and that includes taking into account the reduction of the average working hours in view of the increasing automation.
The automotive industry in Spain generates nearly 2 million direct and indirect jobs. It represents 10% of the GDP and 19% of total exports. Declining sales and extended shutdowns due to the coronavirus pandemic have forced Japanese car maker Nissan last year to shut down one of its 3 plants in Catalonia. Kasai Kadri, Barcelona.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned. Sports news is up next.
join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
The World Trade Organization, WTO, a global regulatory body that contains 164 members and observers, including the United States of America, has blocked a proposal put forth by India and South Africa to grant a waiver to patent protections that are preventing poorer countries from accessing COVID-19 vaccines, says Sam Knight, a reporter, in an article published under the heading Biden's trade representative nominee backs policies that hinder global vaccine distribution. Stay tuned for the details, please. Catherine Tai, President Joe Biden's nominee to serve as the next top U.S. trade negotiator, acknowledged during her confirmation hearing that trade policy over the past few decades benefited corporate interests at the expense of workers and the environment. But Tai declined to commit to making the U.S. Trade Representative's office more accountable to lawmakers and the public. Tai did not respond directly to questions about transparency asked by Democratic members of the Senate Finance Committee. Senator Bob Menendez pressed Tai to support legislation that he co-sponsored, which could create an inspector general serving as an official watchdog for the USTR. Senator Elizabeth Warren asked Tai about the possibility of the USTR releasing draft trade negotiations at least 2 months before Congress is asked to fast-track it so that lawmakers have the opportunity to propose amendments. Under current rules, which were signed into law in 2015 by then-President Barack Obama, Congress doesn't receive the text of trade deals until after relinquishing its treaty negotiating authority to the White House, the so-called fast-track process that Senator Warren referenced in her question. The law that established the current regime is set to expire on July 1st. In response to both lawmakers, Tai hailed the principles behind their inquiries, but did not directly comment on their either proposal. Warren was disappointed. "I very much appreciate that you want to engage with the American people on this, but what I'm really looking for here is a hard commitment," Warren said, in the most contentious moment of the confirmation. "To me, this is another place where the administration needs to take a hard line. Trade negotiations must be open and transparent to the public," she added. Nevertheless, left-leaning Democrats were pleased by her recognition of long-standing progressive critiques of trade liberalization, the practice of eliminating laws that hinder international commerce, even if those laws were crafted to bolster protections for workers, consumers, and ecosystems. For example, while Tai praised the motives behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, just like President Biden has done, should distance herself from efforts to rejoin the agreement. The PPP was widely criticized by labor unions and environmental groups for undermining economic regulations and was opposed by both major presidential candidates during 2016 election. In 2017, then-President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the TPP during his first days in office. "A lot has changed in the world in past 5 or 6 years, and a lot has changed in our own awareness about some of the pitfalls of trade policies that we've pursued as we've pursued them over the most recent years," Tai remarked in response to a question urging the Biden administration to rejoin the PPP from Senator Steve Daines. Tai also noted more broadly that U.S. trade policy in recent decades has primarily served to make winners out of corporate executives and shareholders and losers out of everyone else. "I think that for a very long time, our trade policies were based on an assumption that the more we traded with each other and more liberalized our trade became, the more peace and prosperity there would be," she said. "I think what we see in the parlance of some of the economies who have been thinking about this, over time the trends we see are a race to the bottom. With increased economic activity and trade activity, we aren't necessarily seeing that bring up standards with respect to workers and environmental protection," Tai added. She said, "I think this prompts us to really have this reinform us rethink of our strategic trade policies and figure out how trade policy can be conducted in a way that truly does lift all boats." Pai also touted recent efforts to reverse this trend in response to a question from Senator Sheldon Whitehouse about investor state dispute settlement panels. ISDS are courts established by free trade agreements in which only investors can file litigation against governments for erecting barriers to the trade. White House lamented the existence of such panels, which are part of most trade deals that the U.S. has signed, by noting how Philip Morris bullied Togo out of passing a law that would have added images to cigarette warning labels. The tobacco giant achieved this in 2013 in part by invoking the threat of ISDS action in trade agreements signed by a small West African nation. Additionally, however, Tai said she would defend corporate interests by looking into establishing new mechanisms to defend intellectual property, patent protections for various brands and products, including vital medicines. Intellectual property rights have gained new importance during the global COVID-19 pandemic. The World Trade Organization, WTO, a global regulatory body that contains 164 members and observers, including the United States of America, has blocked a proposal put forth by India and South Africa to grant a waiver to patent protections that are preventing poorer countries from accessing COVID-19 vaccines. The Trump administration led a very small group of WTO members in blocking this important public health initiative, explained Public Citizen Trade Expert Lori Wallach in a virtual press conference held recently. WTO rule changes are typically only approved by unanimous consent. Joining the U.S. in blocking patent waivers on COVID-19 vaccines were representatives of other wealthy countries, including Great Britain, the European Union, Norway, Switzerland, Japan, Canada, and Australia. Unfortunately, in the first two meetings of WTO committees since the Biden administration arrived, the U.S. position has not changed, Wallach noted. Ultimately, Tai was hailed by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and looks set to sail through the confirmation process.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back, everyone. Plenty to come in the next half hour, starting with Iran's ambassador to the international organizations in Vienna warning of efforts to abuse the International Atomic Energy Organization as a bargaining chip, saying such moves would undermine the existing goodwill between Iran and the IAEA. Kazem Gharibabadi said any politically motivated move is also immensely counterproductive with regard to the already existing goodwill and mutual trust between the agency and the Islamic Republic of Iran. The remarks come after the IAEA Board of Governors dropped its decision to adopt an anti-Iran resolution over Iran's reduction of its nuclear commitments under Iran's landmark nuclear agreement with world powers in response to the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the deal, known formally as the JCPOA. The U.S.-backed draft resolution that voiced, quote, serious concern about Iran's reduced cooperation with the IAEA was scrapped in a bid to make room for diplomacy. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, says he believes there's still a window of opportunity for saving the multilateral accord, expressing hope that all sides will return to full compliance. Let's cross over to Vienna, where Homo Lesgius, to get some more thoughts on that. And Homa, what do you think the U.S. was trying to achieve with this attempt at resolution?
Well, this week, when the IAEA Board of Governors session began, the three European countries, Britain, France, and Germany, that are the remaining Western signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran, they drafted this resolution, and it was reported that they had the backing of the United States, and they had circulated that resolution, and in it there was criticism against Iran, the level of Iran's cooperation with the agency, the issue of safeguards-related issues that the agency has been raising for some time now in its report concerning Iran's cooperation and the questions that the agency has, and of course the result of the law that was passed by the parliament restricting IAEA access, the suspension of the additional protocol. These are all the issues that were raised in that resolution. Now, what happened is that we saw on the first day of the IAEA board meeting, Director General Rafael Grossi in his press conference, without directly and in many words referring to that resolution, he did say, however, that he doesn't want the IAEA to be used as a bargaining chip. These were the words of Mr. Grossi himself in political talk. So he was saying that what's important for the agency is for the inspectors to be able to work in Iran, to be able to have the access that they had before, and he doesn't want the IAEA to get involved in what could be described as political games. This was how a lot of the media were seeing this. This was how Iran was seeing this. And of course, we saw yesterday that effort to bring to go ahead with this resolution was finally dropped. That resolution did not go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And Koma, it is known to all that it was the United States that unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA. The question, I guess, is why is there not enough pressure, or any pressure at all, exerted on them to reinstate themselves into the accord?
Now, this is exactly what was said by the Iranian ambassador to the IAEA in his latest address to the board when he was speaking about Iran's positions concerning the JCPOA. He did say that it was not Iran who left the negotiating table, referring to the joint commission sessions that are held regularly to review the JCPOA. It was the United States, he said, that withdrew, and now it's the responsibility of the United States administration to come back. If they want to come back and around the table, if they want to come back to the Joint Commission, something that was proposed earlier, then they have to take measures to show that they are willing to engage and to return to their commitments. So as far as Iran is concerned, and has been reiterated by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, we know that as far as Iran is concerned, they're not going to return to full compliance before the sanctions are lifted. So what they're saying is it's the responsibility of the U.S. to lift the sanctions. The maximum pressure policy, Iran says, has not worked. And what we're seeing from the Biden administration, they say, is in words, they want to be back in the JCPOA, but in action, not anything yet.
In action and not anything else. Moleski in Vienna, of course. And we thank you. To Iraq now. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi welcomed Pope Francis to Baghdad earlier today in the first ever visit of the Pope to the country. Despite COVID-19 and security fears, the 84-year-old head of the Catholic Church stated that he was, quote, duty-bound, adding that he hopes to encourage the country's Christian minority population. During his four-day trip, Pope Francis is expected to call for peace in meetings between the country's religious and political leaders, which has seen increased sectarian tensions since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently spoke to the unelected Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido and reiterated Washington's support for regime change. This followed comments from a White House official who told reporters that the Biden administration was in no rush to lift sanctions against Venezuela, instead calling on the Maduro government to take unspecified confidence-building measures. Under the Trump administration, the U.S. Treasury Department levied successive rounds of sanctions against several sectors of the Venezuelan economy, particularly oil. Despite criticism from multilateral bodies, Secretary Blinken said the Biden White House would continue the policy and look to make sanctions more effective. And about that story, Ahmed Caballo spoke to former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred de Zayas, who visited Venezuela in 2017. And he asked him about Washington's unilateral coercive measures against Caracas.
The economic war, combined with the dramatic drop in the oil prices in 2013-2014, led, of course, to an economic crisis. But an economic crisis that could have been very easily overcome. Why? Because Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, has the second largest gold reserves in the world, has huge bauxite and coltan and lithium and other extremely valuable minerals that they could sell to the world. But if you make it impossible for Venezuela to buy and sell like anybody else, and if you put huge penalties on banks that transfer the money from Venezuela, if Venezuela wants to buy medicine and has to pay for it, well, then you actually asphyxiate the economy. And that is what, starting with Obama, and of course, especially in the 4 years of Trump, that was the policy of maximum pressure. The idea was to cause such chaos in the country that the people would rise up and condemn Maduro, hold them accountable, and overthrow the government so we get the regime change. But when I was in Venezuela on the ground, as I said, I spoke with the opposition. With the National Assembly. I spoke with the Chamber of Commerce, the Fedecamas. I spoke with many opposition NGOs, ProRea, and Human Rights Watch, and Amnesty International, etc., who were all very critical of the government. And I also spoke with the people. I also walked the streets. I went into supermarkets to see what the situation was. And since Spanish is my mother tongue, I mean, I could very easily mix. I go around wearing a bow tie. I walked normally with a guayabera, what they usually wear there. And it was clear to me that the common people blamed not Maduro for the lack of medicine, lack of food, et cetera, et cetera. They blamed the United States.
Ahmed also asked Zayas if he felt that there was any attempt to influence his report following his 2017 investigation in Venezuela.
What was expected of me quite clearly was that I would say there is a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, the humanitarian crisis is exclusively the responsibility of the government. The government is not guaranteeing the economic and social rights of the population. So we should have a humanitarian intervention led by the United States in order to obtain regime change. That is more or less what was expected of me. And I can back that up, because no sooner was it published that I was going to go to Venezuela than I started getting letters, and I have them, from non-governmental organizations ostensibly committed to human rights, asking me not to go, telling me that I was not the pertinent rapporteur. And when it was clear that I would go, they were trying to dictate what should be in my report.
The European Union has scrapped plans for a vote on the post-Brexit trade deal agreement after Brussels accused the UK of violating sections of the signed deal. Earlier this week, Boris Johnson's government announced it would unilaterally be changing parts of the agreement to better suit UK businesses in Northern Ireland. The EU has called the move a violation of the UK's agreement with the bloc, adding Brussels would hold off on voting and not set a date for another vote. The current UK-EU trade deal has provisionally been in force for 2 months, but requires a vote in the European Parliament to become permanent. A shipment of more than 250,000 AstraZeneca vaccines destined to Australia has been blocked from leaving the European Union. Big pharma companies are being pressured to honor their contracts as frustration grows across the bloc, with the vaccine rollout going very slowly and with supplies dwindling. Here is more.
Italy, disgruntled by the delay of vaccine supplies to Rome and general vaccine shortages in the EU, has called for a shipment to Australia to be blocked. By doing so, it is activating for the first time an export control system instituted by the bloc to make sure companies like the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca honour their contracts. Australia says its vaccine rollout will not be affected by the ban.
They are in an unbridled crisis situation. That is not the situation in Australia. But nevertheless, we've been able to secure our supplies and additional supplies for importation both with Pfizer and AstraZeneca, which means we can continue the rollout of our program.
Out of 450 million Europeans, only 11 million have had a COVID-19 jab. Tired of waiting, countries like Denmark, Austria, Poland, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have given up on Brussels and turned to other suppliers. This week, Hungary received its first shipment of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine as another surge of the virus races across the country.
By next week, Hungary will be the most vaccinated country within the European Union. But even this pace is not fast enough to prevent the spread of the virus and especially its new variants.
The EU is only using Western-approved vaccines at the moment. Europe's drug regulator has launched a review of Russia's Sputnik V, which has an efficacy of 91.6%, insisting geopolitics is not affecting decision-making.
I would like to say very clearly, EMA undertakes its analysis of a vaccine based on health-related criteria related to the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. Full stop. There is no other consideration than that. And therefore, geopolitics have nothing to do with the fact that you consider that EMA would consider a vaccine safe and efficacious or not. It's based on the assessment of the vaccine.
Russia says it is ready to provide jabs for 50 million Europeans the moment it gets the green light. Vaccine rollouts will only work if they happen fast and evenly across continents, outsmarting mutations. Amid a surge of cases across the whole of Europe, the EU has launched a continent-wide project to strip out supply bottlenecks and boost production, hoping to redeem itself and stave off a third wave. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia says sanctions imposed on Moscow by the European Union over the situation in Ukraine will be met with a proportionate answer. The EU has extended for another 6 months the sanctions imposed on Russian individuals and organizations accused of undermining the independence of Ukraine. News comes just a week after the EU announced another series of punitive measures on Russia over the alleged poisoning of convicted far-right Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. More than a dozen human rights groups have urged the U.S. to restrict arms sales to Bahrain and address the ongoing, quote, severe deterioration of human rights within the Persian Gulf Kingdom. In a letter sent to the U.S. government, 15 groups urged Washington to pressure Manama over its ban on opposition political parties and free media. They also pleaded for an end to the Al-Khalifa regime's use of torture and other ill treatment. The letter was signed by UK-based Amnesty International, the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, and a number of other organizations. It comes only a month after the 10-year anniversary of the 2011 popular uprising in Bahrain that was met with a brutal crackdown and killing of pro-democracy protesters. The British royal family has been accused of double standards over its investigation into bullying claims against the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle. The co-author of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's biography, Finding Freedom, has questioned why the palace had ordered an investigation into the Duchess, but had not done so with Prince Andrew, who was friends with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and had himself been accused of sexual assault. Others are questioning the timing of the bullying allegations, as they were only revealed after news broke of a controversial interview where Meghan Markle criticized the royal family and referred to them as the firm.
I don't know how they could expect that after all of this time, we would still just be silent if there is an active role that the firm is playing in perpetuating falsehoods about us.
The interview involving the royal couple and American TV personality Oprah Winfrey will air on Sunday.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
It's that time of the broadcast. As we've been reporting, the International Criminal Court has announced an investigation into alleged war crimes committed by Israelis in Palestinian territories. Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda has promised the inquiry would be conducted independently, impartially, and objectively, without fear or favor. We already know the Israeli position on it, but what does the American government think of it all? Let's put that question to Richard Sudan. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. A very interesting introduction. I think, first of all, what we should say is quite interesting, the response on a number of levels. Of course, the Palestinians have welcomed the probe and Israel is opposed to it. And just a quick point here on the media. I've been looking at a lot of different media reports, and there's this kind of language of both sides to kind of give an air of neutrality. But I think what's interesting is, what about the facts? Because the facts is the Palestinians have an absolute right to resist the occupation of their country, and this is enshrined under international law. And of course, Israel has one of the most sophisticated armed forces in the world, possibly in history, bolstered to the tune of millions, or billions rather, by the United States. So a lot of people are saying, by what stretch can this even be considered a war, or two equal sides? Now, just on the note of the United States, I think what's also kind of caught a lot of people's attention is the fact that Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, and their so-called liberal administration have also said that they're opposed to the probe and have reaffirmed their support for Israel. Now, this has really come under a lot of criticism on social media, but what's also interesting is there's a massive wave of support for the Palestinians. People are welcoming the probe, and they really want the facts regarding, you know, what many people would say as Israel's brutal apartheid occupation and war crimes against the Palestinians to really come to light. So in that sense, maybe it's not surprising that Israel and her biggest ally is actually opposing this probe, Saeed.
I think one point that has to be raised is that the Israelis are saying that this whole thing doesn't fall into the jurisdiction of the ICC, whereas the ICC seems to disagree.
Well, not just the ICC. Most serious countries, most serious political analysts, most serious human rights observers around the world actually say, yes, it does fall into that category. I think Israel have described this probe along the lines of something like legal persecution of its soldiers, which frankly most sort of serious analysts on this issue really find absurd, Saeed. So let's wait and see what happens. But I think, you know, regarding this probe, most people that keep a firm eye on the issue are already aware of the massive sort of alleged war crimes against Palestinians, which have been going on for a lot longer than, of course, 2014.
All right, let's have a look at some of the online reaction to this latest announcement.
And there's many of them. Let's go first to one from News Updates, who says Kamala Harris tells Netanyahu that the USA opposes the ICC probe for possible war crimes of Palestine territories. James Johnson says injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. Biden has disgraced America by objecting to a criminal probe of Israel by the ICC. And we have a powerful reaction from Rohan here, who says, if you think an ICC investigation on Palestine is divisive or polarizing, just wait till you hear about the impact of settlements, shooting unarmed protesters, health workers destroying hospitals, killing 556 children in 51 days, and the indiscriminate bombing and rocket fire into Palestinian land.
All right, Richard, let's get back here to the UK and discuss this story that's really kicked up a storm on social media and elsewhere. Tell us why those working for the UK's National Health Service, the NHS, are furious.
Well, they're furious, they're in uproar, because the government and Chancellor Rishi Sunak have proposed a 1%, and yes, I said 1% pay rise for frontline health workers. And this almost seems unconscionable by most honest assessments of the situation, not least because we're in the middle of a pandemic. The NHS has been shown to be more vital than ever, saving lives, essentially, you know, needed more than ever. And, you know, frontline health workers are the ones that have been saving people's lives, often at a cost to their own life. You know, we've lost thousands of NHS workers during this pandemic. And a lot of people are really making the point, too, that Boris Johnson himself, when he contracted COVID-19 last year, he himself acknowledged, you know, the NHS saved his life. Boris Johnson was in an ICU, an intensive care unit. And also it was NHS midwives that also delivered his baby successfully, his newborn baby with his wife, again, during the middle of this pandemic. And a lot of people are saying, look, is this the way that the NHS is being repaid for all the work they've been doing? And actually, as a result of this, Saeed, the NHS are now preparing to strike. And I suspect they'll have the support from many, many millions of people around the country.
All right, let's hear from some of the people who have been watching this story, Richard.
So let's go to Susie Wong, because Tory scum has been hashtagging on social media. Hashtag Tory scum, perpetuating social and financial division, now undermining a century of work and sacrifice to make your country a civilized place to live. And Mark Jessett also chimed in with this: selfishness, arrogance, greed, elitism, unfair advantage, dishonesty, callousness, willful cruelty, a short list of things that make Tory scum. And you know something, Saeed, I scoured online for a long time today and I struggled to find any supportive comments really about the Conservative government in the context of this announcement, which is going to affect, you know, scores and scores of vital NHS frontline health workers.
Pitiful, Richard, is one of the adjectives that people have been using to describe this infinitesimal rise in the NHS workers' pay. Richard Sudan with those stories. Richard, thank you. And we're going to leave it there for now. Don't go anywhere.
in the limelight.